IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The UK and the EU agreed to decide by Sunday whether their Brexit talks are worth continuing as the two sides remain far apart on a future trade deal. France reveals details of a controversial bill that aims to target what Paris calls extremist violence. Critics say the move would discriminate against French Muslims. Also coming up, Texas is joined by 17 other Republican-dominated U.S. states in its legal action to overturn President Donald Trump's election loss. Welcome to World News. We're live from our headquarters in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Our top story this hour, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen says the bloc and Britain are far apart on Brexit trade deal, as Downing Street says very large gaps still remain. The remarks came after the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson met von der Leyen in Brussels to break an impasse over a post-Brexit trade deal. The British government said the two sides agreed to decide by Sunday whether their negotiations are worth continuing. Earlier, Johnson said no British leader could accept the current demands of the European Union. Britain formally left the bloc in January. The UK has since been in a transition period during which it remains in the EU single market. The transition period ends on December the 31st. Jerome Hughes says British people are worried about the future of the country after Brexit.
A lot of people scratching their heads. They're wondering what actually do they really think this can achieve, especially critics of Boris Johnson. They're saying, well, you know, if this is how you can actually get a deal by having face-to-face high-level talks, well, why haven't you done it sooner? Why haven't you been in Brussels more often? A lot of people are saying as well he'd have been much better off perhaps going as a guest to the tomorrow, Thursday, and also Friday to the EU Leaders Summit here in Brussels, so we can actually speak to more of the sort of the key players in the European Union, maybe Emmanuel Macron, Angela Merkel, you know, and so on, and maybe progress things that way. But so people are just wondering what actually will this achieve. And also following earlier today, Wednesday, following his speech in the British House of Commons, Boris Johnson, when he was talking about the type of language that he was using, has actually encouraged people like Sinn Féin, the main opposition party in the Republic of Ireland, which is sort of a key player in terms of Irish politics, saying that it's looking now more and more likely that we're not going to get a deal because of the type of language Johnson was using. He was once again saying that, you know, we will prosper mightily with or without a deal in the UK. And you also outlined some of the issues there. He said it'd be the only country in the world that wouldn't have sovereignty over its fishing waters and so on.
We're staying in Europe, where the French government has defended a controversial bill that aims to fight what it calls Islamic radicalism. President Emmanuel Macron has promoted the bill to target, quote, separatists undermining the nation. But rights groups have raised concerns over the law, saying it would discriminate against and stigmatize French Muslims. Earlier this year, Macron, who was trying to rally support for the bill, said Islam was a religion in crisis globally. The remarks were widely criticized worldwide and led to anti-France protests. The bill in question says, among others, that any person or entity in France is obliged to respect the country's principles of secularism. It also calls for more scrutiny over funding of French mosques. The International Criminal Court says it has reason to believe that British forces had committed war crimes in Iraq.
The office has previously found and today confirmed that there is a reasonable basis to believe that members of the British Armed Forces committed the war crimes of willful killing, torture, inhumane or cruel treatment, outrages upon personal dignity and rape and or other forms of sexual violence. The office has identified a confined number of incidents to reach this determination, which, while not exhaustive, appear to correspond to the most serious allegations of violence against persons in UK custody.
A statement by the ICC chief prosecutor also said that the failure of the military command contributed to crimes by UK soldiers against detainees. It said the British Army's initial response to the crimes was inadequate and lacked impartiality or independence. Despite those findings, the ICC has decided to drop the preliminary probe, saying it concluded that British authorities had themselves examined the allegations. The decision came after the court found no evidence suggesting that the alleged perpetrators had been shielded from scrutiny in Britain. The ICC report, however, acknowledged that not a single person had been prosecuted in the UK with regard to the crimes committed in Iraq, mainly because of a lack of substantial evidence. Political commentator Cindy Sheehan says the US-led coalition's invasion of Iraq in 2003 was a war crime because it was imposed preemptively.
First of all, we know that before the invasion of Iraq, or I don't know if it was Afghanistan or Iraq, the U.S. withdrew from the International Criminal Court and doesn't recognize its authority. But back after World War II, the Nuremberg trials, one of the justices of the Nuremberg trials said that preemptive war is a war crime. There was no reason for the United States to, there was no valid or true reason for the United States to invade Iraq or Afghanistan. And so just invading those two countries was a war crime, and anything that happened after the invasion was a war crime because it's inherently a war crime. Now we know that it's hard to get a true count, but probably over 1 million Iraqi, tens of thousands of Afghan innocent civilians have been killed. The war crimes continue to this day with the poisoning of the country using toxic weapons, toxic products, and things like that.
Elsewhere, Azerbaijan and Armenia have accused each other of using weapons containing white phosphorus during weeks of recent fighting for control of the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. Wounded servicemen and medical staff at a hospital in the Armenian capital, Yerevan, claimed the fighters had suffered burns consistent with the use of phosphorus or another chemical agent. An Azerbaijani official made a similar claim last month. Fierce clashes erupted in late September between Azerbaijan's army and separatists backed by Armenia over the mountainous region. The hostilities claimed more than 5,000 lives and ended after the two sides agreed to a Moscow-brokered peace deal in November that saw Armenian separatists cede parts of their territory. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has said he would discuss strained U.S. relations with the next American president, playing down the possibility of sanctions over Turkey's purchase of Russian missile defense systems. Sashan Saglam has more.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan criticized U.S. administration's comments and actions against Turkish arms deal with Russia. In a presser, Erdogan, however, said he would discuss Turkish-U.S. relations with the next president once he takes office, just like it was the case before.
Aklına herhangi bir şey gelen bakıyorsunuz.
Once he assumes office, we will surely sit down and discuss certain things with Mr. Biden, just like we sat down and talked in the United States or Turkey in the past. We will discuss these again. We do not find the statements and actions they make regarding our arms procurements to be nice. We especially don't find their approach in northern Syria to be right.
Turkey and the U.S. ties have been hit by Turkey's purchase of S-400 missiles from Russia after the U.S. was unable to seal a deal on Patriot missiles. Despite the ongoing tensions and sanction threats, everyone could see the chemistry between Erdogan and Trump. The chemistry that Erdogan-Biden relation is definitely not going to have. Analysts worry about the future of relations between Ankara and Washington.
Turkish President's statement on Turkish-U.S. relations is aimed to build a good relation with Washington, especially now that Joe Biden will take office. However, it is not guaranteed that things will go well due to differences between the two allies. The U.S. still insists on its support to Kurdish militants and tries to impose its strategies on Turkey, which is not acceptable for the government here. Therefore, I think tensions will continue to escalate between the two states.
The tension between the two NATO allies goes back to 2003, when Ankara refused to permit U.S. troops to cross its borders to Iraq. The tensions escalated due to different views on the Syrian crisis and Turkey's purchase of S-400 from Russia. Despite the ongoing tensions, many believe that both Ankara and Washington need each other's support in different arenas. This will force Erdogan and Biden to talk things out. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Elsewhere, 17 U.S. states have filed a motion at the country's Supreme Court in support of a bid by Texas to overturn the presidential election results, which gave Joe Biden victory over President Donald Trump. The Texas Attorney General launched the legal action against the states of Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, all of which were swept by Biden. Ken Paxton argued that coronavirus-related changes made by the four states to voting procedures were unlawful. He has asked the Supreme Court to block those states in the Electoral College. Officials in the four states have dismissed the lawsuits as a baseless stunt. Trump has backed the lawsuit and called it, quote, the big one. Trump's team has already lost 36 cases in federal and state courts alleging fraud. And Brazil has reported more than 53,000 new coronavirus infections, the highest number of cases since mid-August. The figure brings to more than 6.7 million the total number of cases in the country since the pandemic began. Brazil's health ministry said the daily fatalities also rose by nearly 840. That takes the total number of deaths to nearly 179,000 in the Latin American nation. Brazil is the second worst hit country in the Americas. The United States is the worst hit, not only in the region, but also around the world, with more than 15.3 million cases and over 289,000 deaths. Now, several human rights groups have warned that poor countries are set to miss out on COVID-19 vaccines amid a rush by richer nations to hoard them.
The People's Vaccine Alliance, of which Oxfam is a member, have looked at all the vaccine contracts that are on the table across the globe, and we've found that unless urgent action is taken by pharmaceutical corporations and rich country governments, 9 out of 10 people in poor countries are not going to receive a vaccine next year and possibly for years to come.
The alliance, which also includes Amnesty International and Global Justice Now, said rich countries have bought enough COVID-19 vaccine doses for their populations three times over. Campaigners noted that wealthy nations have bought up to 53% of vaccines so far, while they comprise of only 14% of the global population. Rights groups called on governments and pharmaceutical industries to make sure vaccines are available and accessible to all. On Tuesday, the UK became the first Western country to start distributing a COVID-19 vaccine to its population.
The news that people in the United Kingdom are already getting the COVID-19 vaccine has given hope to millions of families across the globe. Families with elderly or vulnerable members are wondering when it will be their turn. According to the People's Vaccine Alliance, which includes Amnesty International and Oxfam, it might be a while. The organization says rich countries are hoarding the most promising vaccines, just as they did during the swine flu pandemic in 2009. Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech have so far sold out, despite promises of fair distribution.
We set out at the beginning to deliver this vaccine to the world, and that means fair allocations across all countries that wish to use our, have our vaccine. So no, not all of the doses that we produce go to the UK. The UK gets, like every country, a fair proportion.
Rich countries have bought more than half the globe's supply of vaccines. That means 1 in 10 people in at least 67 poor countries will not get it unless urgent action is taken. This contradicts statements made by rich nations at the UN after General Secretary Antonio Guterres called on them to make vaccines available to all.
France proposes a donation mechanism so that a portion of the first doses of vaccines available are used to vaccinate priority groups in developing countries.
To end this pandemic anywhere, we have to end it everywhere. We need a united global effort that ensures that everyone has equitable access to a potential vaccine.
Experts say this is blatantly hypocritical, though. Canada has purchased enough vaccines to immunize its entire population five times over. The same goes for the world's highest per capita buyer, the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, countries that are subject to US-led sanctions are being prevented from purchasing the vaccine. Iran is one of them. The US has imposed crippling sanctions on its banking sector and its vital oil and gas industry, and threatened punitive measures against any country or company that does business with Iran.
The pandemic has shown what humanity is capable of at its best and worst, inspiring acts of compassion and self-sacrifice, breathtaking feats of science and innovation, and heartwarming demonstrations of solidarity, but also disturbing signs of self-interest, blame shifting, and division.
The UN is calling for a global ceasefire, debt relief for struggling nations, and a lifting of sanctions amid the COVID-19 pandemic. But it seems these calls have so far fallen on deaf ears. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Iran's National Computer Emergency Response Team says hundreds of cyber attacks are carried out against Iran each year, most of them repelled. Our correspondent Yusuf Jalali has visited the Iranian CERT and filed this report.
Every day, Iran is exposed to over 1 million cyber incidents. This is according to Iran's Computer Emergency Response Team, shortly known as Maher in Iran. Maher says, thanks to its cyber shield launched 2 years ago, it has been able to detect almost all cyber incidents and foil most of them, including the most serious ones targeting sensitive Iranian institutions.
Last year, we detected and repelled 412 million malicious attempts to breach the information of systems in Iran. This means each day over 1 million cyber incidents are taking place. Of course, not all of them are serious, but we're talking about those that could shut down giant companies or organizations. We at Maher focus on those serious malware or cyber attacks and help the targeted institutions fall them.
Maher says Iran has built a strong cybersecurity wall known as Deshfa, shielding Iran's cyberspace against foreign-led hacking attempts. It says last year, the National Cyber Defense System helped thwart 33 million cyber attacks coming from foreign IPs. The Iranian CERT says today, beside conventional warfare, new terms such as cyber warfare or cyber espionage have also drawn government's attention. I asked Maher's CEO about whether malware like Stuxnet, which targeted Iran's nuclear energy program in 2010, could once again infiltrate Iran's cyberspace. He said thanks to the country's advanced cybersecurity wall, Stuxnet will no longer be a threat.
Stuxnet might not be effective today because Iran has rewired its cyber defense based on the latest threats, but it's not unlikely that we could be exposed to a yet stronger malware. So we are constantly developing and enhancing our cybersecurity wall, and it has so far efficiently blocked some of the most destructive cyber attacks.
Maher was launched in 2008 as Iran's National CERT. Affiliated to the Ministry of Information and Communications Technology, Maher undertakes countrywide actions for the prevention of and response to any security incidents in the ICT environment. It maintains close cooperation with Iran's cyber police known as Fatah, as well as international CERTs.
Experts say cyber attacks can be as devastating as conventional threats, only they're not seen. While criminals have shifted to virtual methods to achieve their goals, Maher says it's working 24/7 with other institutions in Iran's cyber defense to keep the country's cyberspace secure for all Iranians. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
With you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Amir Kabir. Khayyam. Maulana. Avicenna. Khwarizmi. Iranian notables, sources of global honor.
In the name of God, salam dear listeners and welcome to the program. In this episode, you will get more familiar with the Iranian poet who lived in 7th and 8th centuries AH, corresponding to 13th and 14th centuries AD. He was Seyf Faraghani. Seyf Faraghani has been known as a leader of socio-political poetry in Farsi language. The 7th and 8th centuries AH were among the bright eras of Iran's literary history, as masters of poetry and Gnosticism like Maulana, Sa'di, and Hafez lived in that era. We have said that little is known about his life and times. You also heard that Saifuddin Abu Muhammad Muhammad Faraghani was born in Transoxiana and left his town Farghane for Asia Minor, current Turkey, in youth. He lived the rest of his life in Aksaray, a small town of the region. Dear listeners, you also heard that the Iranian society was so much chaotic due to the Mongol invasion that most of the literary figures and poets lived in fear and tried to survive. What one finds in the works of that era mirrors the pains and misery of people under the Mongol rule. The sufferings of masses were reflected as complaints in the works of poets and writers, or in the form of comedy and farce of poets such as Sa'di Shirazi and Obeid Zakani. There were three groups in the turbulent conditions of that era. The first group was the laymen, who didn't understand the causes of the existing conditions and just tolerated them. The second group consisted of politicians who had assimilated themselves with the rulers to preserve their worldly gains. But the third group comprised of responsible writers and men of letters who would either try to advise the ruling class or castigated them through satires and sarcasm. Many researchers believe that literature is the idea of a nation, and a society can be known through reviewing the content of its literature. Like many literary figures across the world, Iranian writers and poets have touched upon social issues of their era. Late Dr. Shafi Katkani said, "Literature and literary texts represent the social ups and downs. In other words, they are considered the most important documents of every country. European researchers Volk and Warren maintain that art is a pre-portrayal of nature's engagement with society in a way that a picture of the artist's or writer's social realities can be found in art and literature. Poets and writers are impressed by social and political developments of their era. An examination of the works of the poets of Farsi language indicates that they have a lot to say about the developments that have not been mentioned in history. For instance, the writer of the books History of Iran's Constitutional Period and 18 Years of Azerbaijan's History achieved untold stories of the history of the region and its unknown rulers that cannot be found in any document. Literary works are very important for familiarity with the ideas and mentality of the people of a specific era and region. These works are, in fact, unofficial references of history. Saif Faraghani was an ascetic who felt responsible for the sufferings of his people and tried to mirror them in his works. He was a mystic too. Mystic poetry had existed in the Farsi literature, but once this genre of literature mixed with social pains, it turned into a sore on the head of corrupt and cruel rulers. The poetry of Saif is the same sword and cry. As a matter of fact, dealing with the social problems of people used to exist among Iranian poets, but few poets have mentioned these problems as explicitly and caustically as Saif Faraghani. The poetry of Saif Faraghani is the poetry of shouting against oppressors. He neither sat idle in the face of the Mongol invaders, nor did he compromise with them. He protested vociferously. His poetry was the voice of the human conscience. That's why his poetry is alive after the passage of over seven centuries. His poetry functions as a beating heart. It is like a history that a truthful writer has authored. It is a clear perspective of the Ilkhanid rule in Iran and Asia Minor. Saif Faraghani has left a divan or collection of poetry consisting of 10 to 12,000 lines. His poems can be divided in odds, lyrics, and quatrains. Late Dr. Zabihullah Safa has written an introduction to this book, which includes delicate and precise scientific points on his life and thought. A brief look at his divan shows that he had lofty ideas and believed in social progress, unlike many of his contemporaries. Social responsibility and spiritual values matter for him. Well, dear listeners, next time we will continue this discussion.
Maybe we can say that like any other successful person in the world, the first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
My method of tafsir is Quran by the Quran.
We have in the Quran that if you do everything for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and if you have a divine cause, and you follow that divine cause, Allah make you famous. Generally, we have people who go after the popularity, for example, through their like books and the works that they do. But Allama, one of the main characteristics was that he was doing everything for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher, an analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, philosophers, and jurists all across the nation of Islam. And with me in the studio are two experts, two religious experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Dr. Murtaza Rezazadeh and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to your show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome, brother. And Dr. Murtaza Rezazadeh, thank you very much, brother, and assalamu alaikum to you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for having me.
From today onward, we want to talk about a personality who is considered maybe one of the most and maybe the most prominent thinker in the modern Shia Islam, and he had expertise in different fields of studies. He was a polymath, in fact, and his comprehensive personality made him one of the greatest trainers, teachers, and philosophers of contemporary Iran, and not only Iran, in the world of Islam. And he is no one but Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Tabatabai, mainly known as Allama Tabatabai. Allama, in fact, is an honorific title used for a polymath in Farsi and Arabic language. Okay, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, let's start with you. Muhammad Hussein Tabatabai, Allama Tabatabai, what made him very special among the other thinkers and philosophers of contemporary Iran and the Islamic world?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Allama Tabatabai, as he is known by his great works in the philosophy and in the Quran, the most important thing that we can say in his life was the, we can say, sincerity and doing all his works for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because we have in the Quran that if you do everything for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and if you have a divine cause and you follow that divine cause, Allah make you famous. Generally, we have people who go after the popularity, for example, through their like books and the works that they do.
That's right.
But Allama, one of the main characteristics was that he was doing everything for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Okay.
Even we have this from his students that one of the ulama, one of the scholars, he came to Allama and he started to praise him for his work of tafsir, like Tafsir al-Mizan.
Al-Mizan, that's right.
And right away Allama stopped him. Mm-hmm. And he said, if you praise my work, it will bring something into my heart and I feel happy for what I have done.
Mm-hmm.
And I will become lazy in my work.
That's
or
right.
Maybe I will have like proud, I will feel proud or become arrogant, for example.
Yes.
So I don't want to have these kind of feelings. So just leave about it and don't discuss these things in front of me. This thing shows that Allama Tabatabai, obviously from his childhood till obviously the last age, he was grown up in the good hands.
That's right.
He was raised by the good teachers.
That's right.
And in the field of ethics, morals, and obviously the other fields of sciences, he was obviously a good student and a good learning student.
It was very kind of you. So we can consider sincerity and good teachers. I've heard that
divine cause.
Yeah.
Working for the divine.
He was
cause
the
well.
Direct student of Sayyid Ali Ghazi Tabatabai,
yes.
One of the outstanding. We can say Shia mystics and the masters of the Gnosis in Najaf, in the city of Najaf. Dr. Azazel, let's get to you. So what do you think made Allama Tabatabai very special and we can say different from the other
exceptional
schools? Yeah,
exceptional.
Absolutely,
yeah. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, you mentioned the word that is very important and you said that he had a very comprehensive character and
yes.
That is really important. Allama Tabatabai was different and indeed exceptional among all the other scholars that we have had or we have heard about because he had a personality and a character that included so many different aspects and we can learn from him from all of those different aspects. If we look at his life scientific life,
yes.
We learn a lot. His personal life, family, spiritual life, I mean, all the different aspects of his life are big lessons for anyone who wants to be a successful person. You know, you know that he lost his parents when he was very young in his childhood, and he was raised under the supervision of his older brother. But throughout his life, most of his life, especially when he was a student in Najaf and in other places, he had a very, very humble life, and he had a lot of, you know, problems financially.
Right.
He had to bear with all of those problems.
Right.
And one thing that he never did was to stop trying and learning and doing his best in order to become a great
right.
scholar. So maybe we can say that, like any other successful person in the world, mm-hmm. the first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great efforts and his hard work.
That's all right.
To become to achieve his goals.
Yeah.
And his goals were not limited to the scientific goals.
Yep.
He was an extremely hardworking person in the spiritual life
right.
that he had.
That's right.
So in different aspects, when we see, you know, there are amazing, there are wonderful stories about how serious he was when in his search for knowledge.
Yes.
And this search for knowledge never stopped even until the last days of his life, let alone his youth. You know, one major example is that, you know, when it was the last years of his life and he was sick and he didn't have a good health, mm-hmm. but at the same time, one thing that he was very serious was to keep going to different, you know, gatherings, scientific gatherings. And one beautiful example was that every single week in the last years of his life, although it was very hard for
yes.
him to do that, but he traveled from Qom to Tehran
right.
Without, you know, good cars and
facilities of the time,
yeah,
yes.
Just in order to see a philosopher,
yes.
Henri Corbin, who had come from
yeah.
France,
yeah.
in order to have a scientific discussion with him so that he learns from him and also
yes.
have some, you know, very up-to-date mm-hmm. discussions about philosophy. These are examples of his passion
yeah.
for knowledge.
This is mentioned, we can say, in the memoirs of Dr. Ghulam Hossein Ebrahimi Dinani,
yes.
who is alive now, one of the most outstanding students of Allama Tabatabai in the field of, we can say, philosophy, that I, in the hot summer, and he was very much old, and when I got to Qom to get him to Tehran with the bus and attend the philosophical sessions with Henri Corbin from France, once I asked him, why Allama, in the hot weather, and you are old and you are sick, are coming to Tehran to attend these discussions with Henri Corbin? What's the use? He said, Henri Corbin is my only window to the Western philosophy now.
Yes.
And through him, I can know the current movements of the philosophy in the world. So see how comprehensive Allama was, and what a look, what a beautiful look, and what a beautiful horizon. We can say he could see in long, long distances.
Especially
of
for
life.
A person at his caliber. He was an Allama
in
the last years of
himself.
His life. He was the most outstanding
okay.
philosopher in
yes.
In the Islamic world.
Yes.
But still he goes and visits another
yes.
philosopher just in order to have scientific discussions.
That's
amazing.
It's the amazing point is that Allama was accepted by all. From the students of the Hawza, I mean very traditional clerics and the, we can say, Rouhanis of the Hawza, to the most broad-minded intellectual and philosophers of his time, like Dr. Hossein Nas, Dr. Darush Shaygan, Ghulam Hossein Ebrahim Dinani. These were great, you know, philosophers of that time, okay? But they were following, of course, Western philosophy. But the thing is that he could attract all the people from different, we can say, classes of the scientists on that time.
And when you
okay.
talk to these people,
mm-hmm.
one of the things that all of them say is that one of the greatest honors that they have had in their
yes.
life is to be the student of Allama Tabatabai,
yes.
and they repeat this up until today.
Yes, that's right.
And this
even,
is because
yeah.
of the amazing character
yeah.
of Allama.
Even the most outstanding, we can say, intellectual, broad-minded ones nowadays, when you talk to them, they claim to be the students
yes.
of Allama Tabatabai. But now Said Mohsen, modern philosophers and thinkers, I mean, they have knowledge and they have expertise in their own field of study, but it seems that sincerity, that belief in the higher and superpower is missed among them. But Allama never, we can say, lost his track in his life. Is it true?
Yes, that is true. And obviously, it is also said that the basics or the base of his philosophy was, or we can say like his philosophy was based on the Quranic teachings. Yes. And that was the main difference between him and the other philosophers of his time. Obviously, we know that he studied the mathematics,
yes,
astronomy,
yes,
and the philosophy, and obviously, yes, the Islamic studies.
Yes.
So in his studies, he had all those necessary, we can say like he knew all those sciences that were necessary for that time,
yes,
for a scholar who needs to be a scholar of being a philosopher or an Islamic scholar. He must have these knowledge. That's why, because he had full command, or he had full command over all these knowledges, that's why he was famous amongst the other scholars as,
yes,
well. That is one thing. The other thing is, during his time, obviously, Ayatollah Marashi Najfi also, he's referring to his tafsir that,
yes,
he did, obviously.
Yes.
We're going to talk about it later. But yes, that is true, that amongst the Shia scholars, we can see like he was the one who could write 20 volumes of such tafsir, which,
yeah,
is a big thing.
Right.
On top of that, one thing that makes different from the other scholars, Allama, which makes Allama different from,
yes,
the other scholars, was that he also knew about the Western philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't only about the Islamic philosophy,
yes,
or Islamic,
yes,
teachings, as Dr. Rezazadeh also mentioned about his dialogues, and you also mentioned about,
yes,
his visits to Tehran.
Yes.
He wrote a book which was The Principles of Philosophy and the Methods of Realism.
Yes.
And that book took out, like that book was a book which guided the youth who were going towards the, you can say, atheism, for example, or towards the kufr,
yes,
disbelieving.
Yes.
Because in that time in the University of Tehran,
yes,
and other universities where there were the departments of the philosophy, the Western philosophy, which has nothing as a backup,
yes,
and it just starts talking about everything from the beginning, and it's, you can say, like, ruin all the bases that you have in the religion. He came up with this book, a small book, which was, I think, 5 volumes, and then Shahid Mutahri also wrote footnotes.
Yes,
he added
that's right,
the narrations,
yeah,
on it, and
okay,
it made, like, there were, I think, there were 14 articles that were written by Allama himself.
Right.
And
okay,
that was a big contribution at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And this contribution saved a lot of, like, we can say, like, the Muslim scholars, and it answered the questions of the Muslim scholars.
That's right.
It answered them, the questions that they have in their minds as well.
Okay.
So that was a big contribution from Allama.
We'll get to that book and the other great works of Allama Tawatabai in the field of philosophy. And what was, in fact, you know, it is a question that how a Rouhani, a cleric, can look at the philosophy. This is very important. Okay, Dr. Rezazadeh, do you have any missed point, brother?
I just wanted to mention another important feature of Allama Tabatabai, and that is his bravery. You know, we have in the Holy Quran, when Allah the Almighty talks about the true believers, he says that الَّذِينَ يُبَلِّغُونَ رِسَالَاتِ اللَّهِ وَيَخْشَوْنَهُ وَلَا يَخْشَوْنَ أَحَدًا إِلَّا اللَّهِ. Those who deliver the message of Allah and fear Him and fear no one except Allah. Why do I say that? You know, Allama was living in a time and in a situation that many people among the scholars and non-scholars, all of them had, you know, extremely somehow oppositions against philosophy and some of those new things that were posed by Allama Tabatabai,
right,
and they made a lot of problems for him,
yes,
at his time. But when he knew that this is his duty and his responsibility to do that, he feared no one and he did what he had to do as his responsibility.
That's right.
And that needs a lot of bravery, a,
yes,
lot of courage, and this is something that we can learn from him a lot.
That's all right. That's all right. And he showed what the true religion is, the religion of Islam, which embraces all the thoughts, and we can say have answers for all of the questions,
yes,
and the ambiguities. But a high caliber scholar like Allama Tabatabai had the capacity, had the spirit,
yeah,
of doing this. He was an exceptional. Thank you very much, Dr. Rezazadeh and Said Mohsen Naqvi. This was only an introduction to the main thoughts and the works of Allama Tabatabai, the main fields he was, we can say, expert in. We'll get into more details of his life and different fields of studies that he was expert in, inshallah, in the upcoming session of the program. It was very kind of you, Dr. Zazadeh and Said Mohsen Naqvi. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you much for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher, which was about Allama Said Muhammad Hussain Tabatabai. Visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also our YouTube page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight. Reaffirming its unwavering support for the Zionist regime of Israel, the United States took radical steps to reject International Criminal Court's authority over its citizens and territory, suspend visas to International Criminal Court's personnel and their families, and condemn the Palestine investigation and any other action that seeks to target Israel. U.S. Hawk Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has repeatedly and wrongly referred to the court, the ICC, as an embarrassing political renegade, an unlawful so-called court, and a vehicle for political vendettas, masquerading as a legal body. In order to shield U.S. and Zionist regime occupiers who have committed war crimes, U.S. President Donald Trump even issued an executive order imposing sanctions on the ICC prosecutor and ICC investigators. Some commentators have expressed doubt that Joe Biden, who has been projected by the U.S. media as the winner of the 2020 presidential election, will be willing or able to reverse this course of action and hostility towards international justice. Confronted by a deluge of politically motivated accusations, the International Criminal Court need not sink to the level of its detractors. Its founding treaty, the Rome Statute, requires the court to stand for justice, determined to put an end to impunity for the perpetrators of international crimes. We're prepared for you an article written by Raji Surani, the director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights based in the Gaza Strip. The piece is titled Palestinian Case at ICC Legal, Not Political. The article has been taken from the AlJazeera.com website. Please stay with us for more of Raji Surani's article. It took International Criminal Court ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda 5 years to conclude her preliminary examination of the situation in Palestine, which found a reasonable basis to believe that war crimes have indeed been or are being committed in the occupied West Bank, including in eastern Al-Quds and the Gaza Strip, and thus to initiate an investigation. Fatou Bensouda's statement on 20th of December 2019, announcing the end of the inquiry, was met with widespread enthusiasm by victims and human rights organizations alike. But the celebrations came too soon. The ICC prosecutor found that the standard of proof for the commission of war crimes was met, and that opening the investigation was appropriate and in the interest of justice. Nevertheless, instead of proceeding, she sought confirmation on the scope of the ICC's territorial jurisdiction from the pretrial chamber. She asked the chamber to take a decision within 120 days. Nearly a year later, victims are still waiting for that decision. As a Palestinian lawyer in the Gaza Strip, I've spent 30 years representing victims of war crimes and crimes against humanity across the occupied Palestinian territories. Since 2009, I have represented the Palestinian victims of Israeli crimes in Gaza before the International Criminal Court, the ICC. Our last resort to ensure the most serious crimes of concern to the international community do not go unpunished. Today, I am increasingly frustrated by the court's painfully slow progress. It is true that international criminal proceedings are typically longer than domestic cases, but it is hard to understand why the substantive investigations into the crimes committed in occupied Palestine have not commenced, despite the evidence uncovered in the prosecutor's preliminary examination. International Criminal Court prosecutor's decision to ask the pretrial chamber to confirm territorial jurisdiction in Palestine and consequent delays risk jeopardizing the effectiveness of the investigation. This wasted precious time and has played into the hands of certain political actors who have attempted to detract from the seriousness of the court's preliminary findings of war crimes. Most notably, the Israeli Foreign Affairs Ministry has published a position paper which attempts to divert attention away from the gravity of the crimes which have been committed and direct it towards the old question, is Palestine even a state? This argument champions a legal and moral absurdity. There can be no victims of war crimes in Palestine if Palestine is not a state. In January, the pretrial chamber issued a call for the submission of observations on the question of jurisdiction. In response 43, Amici Curiae legal opinions were submitted from third states, international organizations, legal scholars, and civil society by the 16th of March deadline. Most submissions did not limit themselves to the technical question of territorial jurisdiction as requested, but interpreted this moment as an opportunity to make claims about the statehood of Palestine, the legitimacy of the proceedings, and their political appropriateness. However, the chamber did not follow up with a timely delivery of its judgment. The politicization of this case engulfed the International Criminal Court proceedings from the very beginning, echoing the fate of previous attempts to seek redress for violations of international law in Palestine through legal mechanisms and forums. A delegitimization campaign was launched against the court, with accusations ranging from taking a political stand to espousing anti-Semitic positions. Reaffirming its unwavering support for the Zionist regime of Israel, the United States of America took radical steps to reject International Criminal Court authority over its citizens and territory, to suspend visas to ICC personnel and their families, and to condemn the Palestine investigation and any other action that seeks to target the Israeli regime. U.S. Hawks Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has repeatedly and wrongly referred to the ICC as an embarrassing political renegade and unlawful so-called court, and a vehicle for political vendettas masquerading as a legal body. In order to shield U.S. and Zionist regime occupiers from committed war crimes, U.S. President Donald Trump even issued an executive order imposing sanctions on the International Criminal Court prosecutors and investigators. Some commentators have expressed doubt that Joe Biden, who has been projected by the U.S. media as the winner of the 2020 presidential election, will be willing or able to reverse this course of action and hostility towards international justice. Confronted by a deluge of politically motivated accusations, the International Criminal Court need not sink to the level of its detractors. Its founding treaty, the Rome Statute, requires the court to stand for justice, determined to put an end to impunity for the perpetrators of international crimes. The only valid approach is for the International Criminal Court, the ICC, to tackle the question as a strictly legal one. In this sense, in concluding her preliminary examination satisfactorily, the ICC prosecutor could have opened the investigation directly. There was no legal requirement to submit a request to clarify the territorial jurisdiction of the ICC, the International Criminal Court. Therefore, her request has brought a heated political debate into the courtroom. Resolving it once and for all at the preliminary stage of the proceedings will avoid incertitude and more unbearable delays in the decision. This strictly judicial approach is not divorced from the reality on the ground. Instead, it acknowledges the critical situation of the victims of Israeli occupation, for whom this court represents the only and last resort. Abandoned by the international community, unable to access any Israeli foreign or international tribunal, and subjected to a cruel occupation, the fate of the Palestinian people is now more than ever tied to that of the International Criminal Court, the ICC. Now the court is at a crossroads. It can yield and collapse under Israeli and U.S. pressure, or it can choose to act upon its object and purpose to ensure that international crimes committed against Palestinians do not go unpunished.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.